From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, actor Chris Maloney, known for playing tough guys like NYPD Detective Elliot Stabler on Law & Order SVU, and inmate Chris Keller on the HBO drama Oz. He plays an ex-cop turned hitman in the series Happy on the Sci-Fi Channel, based on a graphic novel. He predicts it's one of his last physically demanding roles.
You know, beating up bad guys, running around, tossing people over tables at 37 is a far cry different than doing it at 57.
He'll talk about working as a bouncer when he was trying to break into acting and what it was like to leave Law & Order after 12 seasons. Also,
here it is.
The return to glory.
Tiger Woods' come-from-behind win at the Masters Sunday capped a remarkable comeback from personal scandal and injury. We'll hear from biographer Jeff Benedict. You might not recognize the name of our guest, actor Christopher Maloney, but you'd probably recognize him from one of the 12 seasons he played as Detective Elliot Stabler on Law & Order Special Victims Unit, or his role as a sociopathic inmate in the prison drama Oz, or his work on the series Homicide. Maloney now stars in a one-of-a-kind series called Happy. It's based on a graphic novel and combines quirky characters, violent fights and chases, and wacky comedy. It airs at 10 p.m. Wednesday night on the Sci-Fi Channel, and it's now in its second season. Here's a scene from season one. Maloney's character, Nick Sachs, a disgraced cop-turned-hitman, is playing a poker game with a bunch of really tough guys, and he slips into the men's room. There, he talks with a little blue flying unicorn who's actually the imaginary friend of Haley, a 10-year-old girl who's been kidnapped, who, it turns out, is Nick's daughter from an earlier relationship. Happy, the unicorn, is trying to talk Nick into rescuing Haley because he knows Nick was once a heroic cop. Nick realizes that while he can see and hear the little unicorn, nobody else can, including the guys in the card game. So he has the idea to ask Happy to fly around and look at their cards and help him cheat. Happy the Unicorn is played by Patton Oswalt, and Christopher Maloney, as the drug-addled Nick Sachs, speaks first.
Oh my goodness, I have this crazy idea. Do you want to go get Haley?
You bet I do. More than a double scoop of coffee ice cream.
You're going to help me win to get money and guns so we can go get her.
Our teacher, Miss Palm, says it's better to lose honestly than to win by cheating.
Wouldn't Miss Palm want you to help me get guns and money so we could go get Haley?
She'd probably send us to the thinking corner to come up with a creative solution to our problems.
You're right. I just
what?
Just a crazy idea. I just thought we could be a team. You know? Partners. Butch and Sundance. Gin and Tonic. Mickey and Mallory.
You mean Mickey and Pluto?
PB and Mother J.
And that is our guest, Christopher Maloney, with the relentlessly positive unicorn played by Patton Oswalt in Happy, the series on Sci-Fi. Well, Christopher Maloney, welcome to Fresh Air. You know,
thank you.
What fun it must be to play this guy. It's like you pull out all the stops. And I always wonder when actors say, well, I read the script and I loved it, how you can look at stuff on paper and imagine what the production's going to be like, even in a more traditional dramatic film. This one, because it involves animation and just such wild mixes of action. How did you see it? How'd you picture it?
Well, first of all, my biggest concern was what was on the page would not be watered down. I'd seen that before, and I was like, you know, this is one of my last rides doing, you know, a extremely physical, outlandish kind of thing. And I just wanted everyone to be on the same page of if we're going to do this, let's do it right. Let's really portray what's on that page. Yeah. And we did. So I felt as though it was we had nothing to lose. You know, we just go full out and let the audience decide.
So in these scenes where crazy things are happening, a lot of physical violence and all kinds of arguments, and part of it involves this animated unicorn floating in the air, you don't see anything? You're just imagining it? You're talking to nobody?
I actually am talking to our script supervisor, Tony, who does his own wonderful rendition of what happy should sound like. So he helps me, you know, with the beats. But at the end of the day, what's refreshing for me and empowering, I must say, is because I don't have a true co-star, I get to kind of lead the parade. You know, I lead the scene. I guide it to where I think it needs to go because in the moment, I don't have Patton Oswalt giving me his genuine reaction to whatever I say. He has to do that later in post in the studio. So wherever I look is where the animators, you know, say to themselves, oh, okay, so maybe happy darts back and forth here, you know, and that's because my head went left, right, left, right. So it's kind of nice for me.
Right.
You know, so all my co-star's never late to the set.
I think I heard you say a moment ago that you saw this as one of your last rides in this kind of big physical role. Why? You're a young man.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I you know something. Maybe it's my injuries. I'm kind of on
disabled list.
There you are. I'm on disabled list. The DL. I my shoulder has been in. I've been rehabbing my shoulder for 18 months. I have a torn meniscus in my left knee. So, you know, I was, you know, through the second season, I was hobbling about a bit, you know. So, I'll get back into training. I'll get back into tip-top shape, and we'll see how season three goes. But I just found that, you know, beating up bad guys, running around, tossing people over tables at 37 is a far cry different than doing it at 57.
This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with actor Christopher Maloney. He stars in the Sci-Fi Channel series Happy, which airs Wednesday nights at 10. Let's talk a little bit about your background. You grew up in D.C., Washington, D.C., right? Middle-class family. Went to school in Colorado. Studied drama, is that right?
I studied drama, but I walked out of there with a B.A. in history.
Right. And how did you get into serious acting?
Serious acting?
Well, I mean, the kind of thing where you're not doing it for fun, like maybe I can make a living here. Maybe this can be my thing.
I took some acting classes as a lark, you know, as a, in college. And I liked it. And I actually thought to myself, my God, I'm pretty good at this. But even more importantly to me, I realized how little I knew. And that there was something to learn. There was an art here, and I was very curious about it. My father was a doctor, and I just didn't think that I could ask him to pay for my college tuition so I could take costuming and makeup and all that. I just didn't think he'd appreciate that. So I didn't major in it. I took as many classes as I could, and that was that. I graduated. That was it. I went home. Promptly went back to a construction site because that's the only job, basically the only job I'd ever had through high school and college. You know, every summer I'd try and get a construction job. Yeah, but this time I didn't have college to rescue me, so I was a little bit depressed. I was calling around to figure out what guys were doing, what my old classmates from high school were doing with their lives. And I called up a high school buddy and I said, "What are you doing? What are you doing with your life?" And he said, "I'm going up to New York to study acting." And I thought, oh, my God, well, if you can do that, so can I. I asked him for the number. I called up the neighborhood playhouse, and I flew up the next day and interviewed with them.
Yeah, that's a serious acting school, right?
Yeah, yeah. And in the interview, it was for the summer program, the summer school program. In the interview, I'll never forget this, the guy told me to calm. He said, you've just relax. You've got to calm down. I was so desperate. I think of Richard Gere in An Officer and a Gentleman,
right?
Where he tells Lou Gossett Jr., "I've got nowhere else to go."
Right, right. I remember that
desperate moment of his.
Right, right.
I'll never forget. I go, oh my God, I'm living the Richard Gere Officer and a Gentleman life right now.
So you got in, but I mean, you didn't immediately start getting big paid roles, right? I mean, you had to support yourself in New York.
Yeah. Yeah, I was a bouncer and a bartender and a trainer, and you know, I was sleeping on people's couches, and I was America's favorite guest for the first six months.
You were a bouncer, and I know that you played football in high school. So did you ever have to actually have to toss people out of bars?
I did.
Yeah,
I did. There were a lot of interesting moments that happened. Yeah, I was a bouncer at the Bitter End and Kenny's Castaways. Which are, well, Kenny's is no longer there, but the Bitter End is pretty iconic. They're right down there on Bleecker Street in the Village. But, you know, if anything, I'm the worst bouncer to have because I'm 6 feet, about 200. So, you know, I'm big, but not, you know.
You're not towering over people.
Yeah, right? I'm not towering. You know, I'm not, you know, you look at me and I'm the perfect size for most guys to go, well, you're not that big. Well, you think you're tough. So I was like, oh boy, really? Do we have to do this? So yeah, I tossed a few people out. Tossed more people out with help from my friends. So yeah.
So you're working as a bouncer and other jobs, and you're working on your craft in the classes, and then you're going to auditions. Right? You want to work. What did you learn about how to audition?
What an absolutely separate art it was from actual acting. Hmm. And at the end of the day, it was more of a Zen practice and a psychological, you defined psychological tricks for yourself to trick yourself into confidence and to almost manipulate the room. And if you're trying to please them, it's just like any relationship, you're toast. You have to, who am I vis-a-vis this character? And this is it. And once you do that, once you're able to do that, all of a sudden you go into auditions feeling more empowered, and you walk out being far more satisfied and empowered.
Well, I wanted to talk about Law & Order, which is probably the role you're, I assume, best known for. You spent, 12 seasons there. And you worked as Detective Elliot Staber working on special victims crimes with Mariska Hargitay, she played your partner. Were you guys together the whole time you were there?
Yeah. We screen tested together. We tested for the role together. There were six actors.
So you didn't know each other beforehand, huh?
No.
And why do you think you got the part?
Oh, boy. You know, all the actors who screen tested were great. But and this is one of the rare moments when I walked in with Mariska. First of all, we were walking down the hall, and I was telling her a joke, telling her a story that was a funny story. And we walked into the room with all the suits and, you know, all the decision makers. And I said, hold on, guys, let me just finish this story. And from that, and the chutzpah, I thought about it afterwards, but that was the idea of you guys will hold on because we got control of the room. We're in here and we got control of everything. We're going to control this scene and our characters. And it was pretty obvious. Even though I hadn't seen what the others had done, I walked out of that room going, wow, that was it.
Well, I wanted to play a clip here. In this scene, you are, as Detective Stabler, interrogating a child rapist who's been eluding you for years. He's played by Matthew Modine. And the scene begins with you, as Detective Stabler, leaning right into the suspect's face.
I don't need a PhD to know what kind of person you are. You're a loser. But you had a tough childhood. That makes you special. That makes you a victim. You're nothing. You contribute. Nothing. The reason your life sucks is because you've done nothing.
I've done nothing.
You counting the little children that you've raped and murdered? Is that what you're saying to me? You want to walk me through that, you piece of garbage? Tell me how good you are at torturing children. Tell me how strong you've got to be to kill a little girl. Huh?
And that's our guest, Christopher Maloney, in Law & Order SVU, in a scene with Matthew Modine. A lot of intense stuff in this series. And you know, it's known that people that do this kind of investigative work who track predators who prey on defenseless people and commit the most awful of acts. It's psychologically damaging. It's hard to sustain. You did this for 12 years. You weren't, it wasn't real. But, I don't know, did it take a toll on you? Did it affect your mood?
Yeah, first of all, let me just say, the real SVU detectives, because we toured their facilities and we got to speak with them. Boy, they're really heroic, and they would tell us a few stories you can't believe it. There are moments of true horror out there that these civil servants try to take care of. They're the heroes. So, having said that, we took our roles seriously. And I say roles even in a larger context, because it slowly dawned on us that it was more than just a procedural show, that it had larger ramifications about the messages that was being sent out. The idea of sexual abuse was more prevalent than being allowed to be gotten out there. This is happening every day, and we need to have a dialogue about it. And, I just feel as though it was a very important show about touching on all aspects, whether it's gender issues, sex abuse, spousal abuse, all of these things, child abuse. You know, it became less of a job and more of a, I wouldn't say a crusade or a something larger than ourselves. I'll say that.
Right.
And, you're doing these scripts back to back, and it would take eight days to do an episode. So, you start on Monday, and the following Wednesday you finish, and Thursday you have your new script. And this continues for 9 months. And after about 4 or 5 months, you're more liquid than solid. It just, the horrors just keep coming and coming. And invariably, it was the women. Are women writers who would write the toughest scripts. They pulled no punches. And I think the guys would feel intimidated or something, but the
restrained,
women.
Restrained, yeah.
Yeah, restrained, that's a better word. Mm. The women would just lean into it. So anytime I would see a female writer had written the script on the front page, I'd take a deep breath and go, oh boy, here we go.
You left the show after 12 seasons. What was it like? I mean, it just had become a part of your life for so long to not have that.
What it was like, and I knew it, I was actually very proud of myself. I always thought when I do this, I'm going to feel like the house cat that got locked out of the house. Mm. So this pampered animal, you work your whole career for what I got. I hit the jackpot. I hit a show that meant something, was well written, was well received. You loved the working conditions and the people. It was a well-run machine. Every aspect was there. And yet, fill in the blank, the artist in me, the restless actor or creator, that guy needed to move on. So in the interim, I just worked on other projects and I got my pilot's license because I figured I really needed to truly focus on something that was, without question, a life or death endeavor.
This is something I didn't know. You fly airplanes.
Yeah. I got type-rated to fly a jet.
But so this was something that you kind of felt you needed to do? The thrill, the danger of it, or what?
I started SVU as a, sometimes very employed actor, but always, a journeyman type actor. And all of a sudden I had a home, and I had a lucrative home. And I had a satisfying home, and I built a family. I built a whole life. And I knew if I was walking away from all that, I needed to place that focus. Because, if you're an unemployed, an actor, unemployed is not a good thing, especially when he's been employed. So, and I knew that about myself. I needed to employ myself in something that was that required every fiber of my being to stay focused and on top of things. And it was also good for my brain. I mean, I often said that I've never studied, I haven't studied that hard since college.
Hmm. Wow.
Getting all of my ratings.
Christopher Maloney stars in the series Happy, now in its second season on the Sci-Fi Channel. After a break, he'll talk about his role in the brutal prison drama Oz, how spending a night in jail informed his performance, and how he got into the mind of sociopathic inmate Chris Keller. And we'll talk about the peculiar path of Tiger Woods' career and his remarkable comeback with Jeff Benedict, co-author of a widely read biography of Woods. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. We'll end this half of the show with a song featured in Christopher Maloney's series Happy, performed by Anne Margaret and Patton Oswalt.
Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face, brush off the clouds and cheer up.
Put on a happy face?
Take off a gloomy mask of tragedy, it's not your style. You look so good that you'll be glad you decided to smile.
Pick out a pleasant outlook,
or stick out that noble chin.
Wipe off that full of doubt look,
and slap on a happy grin.
And spread sunshine all over the place, and put on your hat.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Going Through It, a new MailChimp original podcast hosted by Ann Friedman. Listen as Ann sits down with guests such as Rebecca Traister, Soledad O'Brien, Samin Nosrat, and Hillary Clinton to hear about the pivotal moments in their lives, careers, and relationships when they had to decide whether to quit or keep going. Subscribe and listen on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, while you were still doing Law & Order, you had this mm-hmm. role in Oz, the HBO series about prison life.
Yeah.
Where you played Chris Keller, who is, well, why don't you describe him? He's an inmate. Tell us about this character.
So Chris Keller was introduced season two of Oz to play the nemesis and lover to Lee Tergesen's Tobias Beecher. And I was there to manipulate him, and yet I fall in love with him. And I never considered my character gay. I just thought he was omnisexual. I thought he was just used sex as a weapon to manipulate people. And he has a relationship with Tobias Beecher.
And a sociopathic streak, fair to say.
Okay, so he was a serial killer. You got me, okay?
Right.
I have to tell you everything?
If we're going to quibble, yeah. well, let's listen to a clip. Here you are. You've been in this relationship with this guy, Beecher, as you mentioned. And in this case, you have attacked him and broken his arms and legs. And you're meeting to the prison counselor, played by Rita Moreno, who wants to talk about this and about you. Let's listen.
You enjoy sex with men?
I enjoy sex, don't you? You told me you were married before you became a nun. You and your husband have great
Chris.
Sex. I mean, I can tell you did. I bet you were wild. Lent. You miss it? Sex.
I miss my husband.
Sure. You ever have sex with anyone other than him?
Chris, you know, every time we have a session together and we get to a topic that you want to avoid, you somehow manage to turn the discussion around to me.
You noticed, huh?
I just want to get to the heart of why you did what you did to Beecher.
You.
You saw my ex, Bonnie? When I met her, she was all alone, very unhappy. So I knew it'd be easy to get her to fall in love with me. But what I didn't know was after I broke her heart, would she still love me? See, I'm a piece of I am worthless. As bad as they come. And to have someone keep loving me, no matter how bad. You happy now? You got me to open up and spill my guts all over your table.
And that's our guest, a pretty twisted Christopher Maloney in the HBO series Oz. How did you prepare for this role about prison life and this guy who's a long way from who you are, I'm sure?
Well, I got in a bar fight when I was 19, when I was thrown in jail. And that experience, I think, echoed with me. I only spent the night in jail. And I'll never forget how hard everything was. The bench was concrete. The bars, obviously, were very hard. The floor was cement. Everything was cold and hard. And no one cared about anything. They're just going through motions, pushing people to and fro from one cell to another. And I often thought about that, and that's, you know, how that environment molds attitudes.
Besides that, I mean, your character, Keller, was a real predator, and I'm wondering kind of how you got that side of his character.
Boy, I think this might sound, I think I'll say this. Obviously, I possess an aspect of that, or I am drawn to that. Since I was a child, I would always be drawn to the true detective type magazines, the book Blood Letters and Bad Men, which was a history of criminals. And I've always been fascinated by that mechanism of wanting to do harm to someone and what that psychology is. Less so now. Mm-hmm. I think I really have scratched that itch or fed that beast. But right. At the time, I was really, I was fascinated by it.
There's some pretty brutal violence in Oz. Were there ever members of your family that you wouldn't want to watch it?
my mother never watched. I don't think my father did. My brother and sister would get reports. And that's you know, they'd be at the water cooler going, I saw your brother's beep last night.
Oh, wow.
Or I saw your brother beeping another guy last night. Let's put it this way. My career, as far as my family is concerned, began with the Finelli Boys, a sitcom in 1990, and then re-picked up in 1999 with the SVU gig.
Uh-huh. Okay. You know, you were talking about how some of the plot lines that the writers came up with were really disturbing in SVU. Did you ever encounter a plot line or something in a script that you just felt you couldn't do or that you asked to be changed?
Oh, well, I asked a lot of things to be changed. But not as far as any crime was concerned. I would have a problem because they have a formula to fill in, and sometimes you need to get to, you know, at page 15, there needs to be a dramatic moment. And so they'd have us arresting someone, where you're like handcuffing and arresting someone. That would actually be the biggest bugaboo for me. I'd be like, but there's no reason. We have no cause to handcuff. And it makes us look stupid. That would always be my You know, I had to be the defender of my character. You know, they'd have us arresting some guy and be like, guys, you know, that's for you. That's, you're making me look like an idiot.
You mean someone who is happy to go downtown, you don't need to cuff him and throw him in the wagon?
Yeah, except that has less impact. There's less oomph. You know, me going, sir, we're going to have to go down and talk. Commercial break, as opposed to, you, come here, grab him, slam him against the car, cuff him. We're going downtown. commercial break.
You know, it's interesting. You were doing Oz, the prison show, and Law & Order at the same time. In Oz, you're a predator. In Law & Order, you're catching predators. What was it like to play both sides of it? Did they feed each other, or?
No. As a matter of fact, they weren't helpful at all. It was a completely different energy, environment, planet, engagement of people. I often worried whether one was bleeding over into the other, whether Elliot Stabler from SVU was making Keller soft, or whether Keller was making Elliot, you know, just...
more too, crazed, yeah.
Yeah, too animal, too crazed, whatever. I walked away from that experience very glad, you know, to have this opportunity, because it wasn't lost on me. I would walk around going, like, you know, how many actors get to be not on one, but two really great shows to do at once? I mean, it just doesn't happen in New York, especially New York City. Like L.A., there might be a lot of production happening, but, you know, in New York, there wasn't as much production happening in those days in New York. But I definitely walked away from that always not quite sure that I did my best work. And I didn't want to know the answer, so I never looked back.
The one other thing I have to ask you about, you were the quarterback of your high school football team and you went undefeated. Is this true?
That is true.
You know, for most guys, like, their lives would be all downhill after that. Didn't define you, huh?
It actually did define me. Oh. And I, leading into my senior year, I had been on defense. I'd played on defense. I'd been a starter on defense. And, you know, but I was the backup quarterback on my sophomore and junior year. So senior year, this is now my turn, my shot. And I set three goals for myself. One was obvious, I'm going to be the quarterback. Number two, I wanted to be captain, and I wanted to go undefeated. And I willed that. I prayed for that. It happened, and I walked away. That defined me. And how it defined me was I felt that if I put my mind to something, I could bend the spoon. I could do anything I wanted to. I used that moment, and it's stayed with me. I still carry it, and I treasure that moment as one of the top five things that ever happened to me.
Well, Christopher Maloney, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
The pleasure was all mine. Thank you.
Christopher Maloney stars in the series Happy, which airs Wednesday nights at 10. It's now in its second season on the Sci-Fi Channel. Coming up, writer Jeff Benedict talks about the rise, fall, and resurrection of Tiger Woods' career. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Mayo Clinic. When the search for the right answer becomes the most important journey of your life, when a clear diagnosis would mean the world to you, when finding new options could help you find hope, you know where to go. Mayo Clinic. Find out more at mayoclinic.org/answers.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another, and we're making the month of April all about women in comedy. We've got Greta Lee and Leslie Headland from the Netflix series Russian Doll, the beloved Retta from NBC's Parks and Recreation, and many more. Spread the word, listen, and subscribe now.
On the last hole of the Masters Golf Tournament Sunday, Tiger Woods made sports history when he stood over a 2-foot putt on the 18th green.
Many doubted we'd ever see it. But here it is. The return to glory.
Wood's fifth Masters title at age 43 followed a 10-year drought of major tournament victories and completed a remarkable comeback from a personal scandal that all but ruined his reputation and back surgery that left him unable to swing a club at all. For some perspective on Wood's career and his achievement, we turn to Jeff Benedict. He's the author with Armin Katayan of a widely read biography published last year called Tiger Woods. It's now out in paperback. Well, Jeff Benedict, welcome to Fresh Air. Tiger Woods dominated golf like nobody ever, like few people dominate anything, really. Give us a sense of how he was trained for this life and skill. How young was he when he started learning golf?
I think it's fair to say Tiger was 2 years old when he really started to learn golf. He was one when he started watching his father play golf or practice golf in the garage, and that was a daily regimen where he would sit there and watch his father putt. By the time he was two, Tiger was putting and starting to practice and learn things with his dad. He was in golf all the time. By the time Tiger's 12 or 13, there's some really intense training going on that goes beyond what most parents would deem appropriate. Earl would do things like they were demeaning. I mean, he would call Tiger very demeaning names, names that I can't use on the air. It was an attempt to put him down or break him down in a mental way, in an emotional way, while Tiger was practicing. It was intended to toughen him and really prepare him for what was ahead. They had a code word between the two of them. The word was enough. And Tiger was to use that word if his father ever pushed him too far. He never used that word.
His dad, Earl, was African-American. His mom, Cultida, was Thai. And Earl would sometimes yell racial epithets at Tiger. Was that to prepare him for a racist world that he would encounter?
I think part of the reason he used those epithets was because Earl had a really good understanding of where his son was going. He knew that where Tiger was going was the country club set. When he was a young boy and a teenager, Tiger that is, Earl was constantly looking for ways to help his son beat the country club kids who had all the advantages of wealth and socioeconomic status. And so part of that, those racial epithets, yeah, he that's part of what's factored into it. Tiger would be competing on golf courses as a teenager where there were no kids of color. There were no parents of color. There was just nobody of color at these clubs. And then this boy would walk out onto the course and all eyes would be on him because he was, not only did he look differently than everybody else, but he was so much better than everybody else. And there's a tremendous amount of pressure, emotional pressure that comes with that. And Earl was trying to put a shield or force field around his son that would enable him to cope with that when he reached the PGA Tour.
When he joined the PGA Tour, there are a lot of ways to measure this. How good was he?
He arrives like a comet. I mean, if you think about it, in 1997, he hasn't been on the tour for a year yet, and he goes to the Masters and wins by a record margin. I mean, you're talking about a boy, basically, right? He's just come out of college as a sophomore, and he doesn't just win the Masters, he trashes the Masters. He completely annihilates the field. His driving distance off the tee is so much farther than everybody else. It's a bit like watching a bionic man hit a golf ball. And everybody's watching this going, this is the future? I mean, this kid's just got here. Everybody's playing for second place. I mean, that's how he arrived.
You know, I read in your book about that Masters in which he made history by setting course records and tournament records, that, you know, a major golf tournament is 72 holes. The first 9 holes, he played horribly. He would have been sent home, except he turned it around after 9 and refocused. This is remarkable.
It is, and I think that that's one of the reasons that to this day, Tiger Woods gives tremendous credit to his father. There's a bond between them. There's a reason for that iconic moment at the end of that Masters where Earl and Tiger are embracing and crying into each other's shoulders and expressing I love you to each other. That was sort of the culmination of the 18 years of grinding, driving, training between Earl and Tiger. And it paid off with that Masters. That's the role, really, of Earl that you saw come out in Tiger. He was there for that Masters, and frankly, he shouldn't have been, because Earl was ill, and his doctor advised him not to go. But he went, and he had a role in helping Tiger turn it around mentally.
Tiger Woods had a remarkable career as a professional. I want to talk about, though, what his body went through. It's interesting, you know, you see some golfers, I mean, I play the game a little, and you see some golfers who have a nice, relaxed swing, and the ball just takes off like a rocket. But Tiger didn't. I mean, every time he swung a club, even one of the shorter clubs, it was just an explosion of impact. Tell us a bit about what his body went through and the toll that it took on him, all the practice and play.
I think the best way to describe or differentiate Tiger's, not only his swing, but his approach to golf is this, that when he first joined the PGA Tour in 96, the adjective that was used to describe his swing was violent. Violent is not a word you typically associate with golf. I mean, that's a word for football or boxing. But Earl was all about weaponizing his son. When Tiger struck the ball, it was like an explosion. His high school girlfriend told us that the first time she witnessed Tiger drive a ball at a driving range, it felt and sounded like a rocket taking off. Now, over time, his swing coach, Butch Harmon, was concerned that violent torque of a swing on his back was going to have some negative consequences. They were actually trying early on to tone it down. Even his youth instructor was trying to get him to not swing so hard and so violently. But on the other hand, that was part of who he was and part of what made him great. But it did take a toll.
And he finally got what, spinal fusion surgery? What does that mean? What did it mean for him?
The fourth and final back surgery that Tiger Woods had was a spinal fusion surgery. And, you know, there was a lot of question as to whether that would work, whether he'd be able to return. Most experts and prognosticators predicted that he would never play again. The thing is everybody underestimates who this man is and how this man was made. And I'm talking more now about not about how he was built physically, but I'm talking about how he was built mentally. And there's things like determination and grit that Tiger possesses, and to a degree that I think really separates him from everybody else. And I don't just mean the other golfers on the PGA Tour. I'm talking about athletes in general. He's a rare world-class athlete that has grit and determination and a pain threshold that just, it's unlike any athlete that I've seen or written about.
Jeff Benedict is the author with Armin Katayan of the book Tiger Woods. It's now out in paperback. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Samuel Adams. Of all the beers Sam Adams has ever brewed, Boston Lager is their all-time favorite. With its distinctive balance of spicy hops, sweet roasted malts, and smooth finish, it stood the test of time and helped launch the whole craft beer revolution. Sam Adams Boston Lager. Full-flavored, rich, and complex. There's nothing quite like the taste of an original. Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor responsibly.
America has a long history of white nationalism, and its influence reaches farther than you might think.
You can go back and you can read the New York Times coverage. You can read Hitler saying it was America who taught us we should not open our arms equally to other nations.
This week on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with Jeff Benedict. He is the author with Armin Katayan of the biography Tiger Woods, which is now out in paperback. His marriage exploded in a scandal in 2009. Turned out he'd had multiple extramarital affairs. And in general, it's fair to say, looking at this biography, that he was in many ways not the most admirable person. I will say I give some slack to people who get fame and wealth at a very young age. I mean, a lot of us do stupid things when we're young, and we just don't have the means and the attention for them to be so noticed. How much has he changed? What's your sense of that? Is he different towards other players, fans, other relationships?
I think he's evolved. He's evolved a lot over time. He's in his 40s now. He's been through more than it's hard to actually find someone on the planet that's been through things comparable to Tiger because of the fame he had. So when he made the mistakes that he made, we all watched them in real time, and it was a colossal fall from grace. He was mimicked, he was mocked, he was criticized, he was made fun of, he was the butt of jokes on late night television. Where I think this changed was the way he dealt with that. I've never seen a public figure respond to controversy the way he did. He faced the cameras, he answered the tough questions, he didn't run and hide. He took it, and he took it in a way that I think impressed people. People might not have been impressed with what he did, but the way he responded to it, I think, was the beginning of a change. And then you had that 10-year period from 2009 when he had the car accident till 10 years later where he went through all the injuries. And now what you're seeing is he's a father with children. He's a super dedicated dad. He's got his career back. He thought he'd never play again. Now he's playing again. He's got his health back and his mobility. And I think he looks at everything differently. He looks at the game differently. He looks at life differently. You can see it. There's a genuineness to the way he is engaged with people now. This is not an act. It's not the nasty thing you saw 15 years ago when he was at the pinnacle of his game. What you're seeing now is a guy, I think, who loves what he's doing. To me, that potentially makes him more dangerous. As long as he stays healthy, he could be really hard to beat over the next few years.
So what he did last weekend, winning the Masters at age 43 after debilitating surgery and his, you know, the blow up of his career, how big is this in the annals of sports?
It could very well go down as the greatest comeback in the history of sports. What he came back from is unprecedented because of just how far he'd fallen. This wasn't just, you know, a decent golfer who had some public humiliation. This was the greatest golfer of all time. This was one of the greatest athletes in history who had an incredibly precipitous fall that took him right out of the game. It turned his life upside down, and we all watched it. And then it culminated with the series of injuries that took him out of the sport entirely. People didn't expect him to ever play again, let alone come back and do something like win the Masters. The reason it's doubly great is because this is a comeback story that transcends sports. We all know what's happened to him in his private life because it played out so publicly. And so the message of Tiger's life, I think, has become, you know, just because you're down doesn't necessarily mean you're out. And that's a message that resonates with a lot of people who may not even care about golf or sports in general. I think that there's a lot of people that have watched this, and the reason they've been inspired by it is because they got introduced to him after the scandal, and that's when they realized, oh, this was a great golfer. Look what's happened to him. And now they see that he's turned all that around, and he's gotten it back.
Jeff Benedict, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jeff Benedict is the author with Armin Kotayan of the 2018 book Tiger Woods. It's now out in paperback. It's baseball season, and on tomorrow's show we learn about fastballs, curveballs, screwballs, and spitballs from New York Times national baseball writer Tyler Kepner. He talked to hundreds of pitchers about what they throw and how they try to get a mental edge over the hitters they face. His new book is K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. Join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Thea Challoner directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.